Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director, here with Mara Levinsky, executive editor.
Hi, everyone.
Well, Mara, the moment has arrived. Bo and Hope are officially heading back to Days of Our Lives next week, and we have the exclusive preview with head writer Ron Carlovati in our new issue. So picking up, the next chapter of their arc was always in the plans after the Peacock spinoff Beyond Salem Chapter 2 aired. But while the team was waiting for news about a Chapter 3, the news that Days itself was moving to Peacock was released, and the show quickly pivoted to incorporate the tale into the mothership, as it's now called. So to that end, they contacted Christian Alfonso and Peter Reckle about returning, obviously as Bo and Hope, plus Steve Burton as Harris, Miranda Wilson as Megan, Victoria Conifol as Sierra, Christopher Sean as Paul, and Colton Little as Andrew Donovan. So we're also going to see Robert Scott Wilson, who's currently playing Alex, reprise the role of Ben for the story, which is going to play out for a while, as I understand it. And this whole story is going to tie into what's happening with Kayla, Marlena, and Kate. So there will be a lot of fan favorites included here. And Ron says it feels like an old school day story. So trust and believe, I will be tuning in for every moment.
Same here. Another imminent return we're reporting in the new issue is that of Torsten K, whose Ridge has been absent from B&B for a bit in the wake of the character's two love interests, Brooke and Taylor, both giving him the heave-ho. We will see him again on March 15th. And other big news that came out of B&B this week is that the character of Ridge Forrester Jr., formerly known as RJ, the only shared offspring of Brooke and Ridge, will be heading back to Los Angeles in the form of soap newcomer Joshua Hoffman. That is very exciting to me because we haven't seen that character since 2018. But of course, you know, his bloodline makes him as connected as you can be to most of the key players on the canvas. I feel like he's a character who's basically a blank slate because he was a teenager when we last saw him. So who knows how his personality may have shifted over the last half decade.
Oh yeah, I am super excited about this casting, especially because so much has gone on with his family since he was last there. I mean, I feel like we're always like, where's RJ, or now Ridge Jr.?
Right.
I think, you know, he'd want to check in on them at some point. So happy to hear he's on his way home to Los Angeles. Another piece of fun news comes from Hallmark. There'll be another Hannah Swenson mystery, which means Days alum Allison Sweeney, who played Sammy, and General Hospital's Cameron Matheson, who plays Drew, are teaming up again for it. So they've been up in Canada filming alongside another soap alum, Barbara Niven. And I am super excited to see this new film, which is called Carrot Cake, a Hannah Swenson mystery, and it will premiere later this year. So also in the new issue, we have an interview with General Hospital's Michael Easton, who plays Finn, but has also portrayed a few other roles in Port Charles. So you got to speak to him, which absolutely delighted me because, you know, he's not a guy that does a lot of press. But I remember when we were at Super Soap Weekend one year, he took part in a Q&A session, and I found him so engaging and funny that I always wished he did more.
Yeah, Michael is like one of the most charming conversationalists in all of daytime, in my humble opinion. And this interview really just emerged organically out of a larger conversation that we were having about his experience on GH. Obviously, he has had a unique run because he has played a multitude of characters in the Port Charles universe. And I really enjoyed hearing his perspective on things that worked, things that didn't quite work. And we had some hearty chuckles over the fact that his doomed character, Silas Clay, has had more of an active life since he died, since he was posthumously revealed to be the father of both Nell and Willow. But if you are a Michael Easton fan, run, do not walk to that feature because he's so funny and so insightful. And there couldn't be a better combination, in my opinion.
Hear, hear. Well, our guest today actually knows a thing or two about Michael. It's Gregory Harrison, who plays his on-screen father, Gregory Chase, but has lived quite a successful Hollywood life out of Port Charles. So let's catch up with him and see what's going on. Hi, Gregory.
Hello.
How you doing?
How you doing? I'm good.
We are good too. We are excited to talk to you today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Well, so we are going to go deep into the life of Gregory Harrison, and we're going to start where you grew up. So as I understand it, you grew up on Catalina Island, an island off the coast of California. So how did your family settle there, and how would you describe what your childhood was like there?
Oh, boy. Well, my grandfather came from Dublin, and he sort of worked his way across Canada. I think he was felling lumber up in the Yukon and eventually worked his way down into the States. And he came down with some kind of a strange joint disease. And the doctors all said, you got to go to the Pacific Ocean. That's where the healing waters of the Pacific will help you and the dryness and of the desert. And actually, he went through Phoenix first. It didn't get any better. He went to Redondo Beach back in like 1905 and didn't help. And they said, no, the healing waters are over there. And they pointed across. You could see Catalina 26 miles across the sea. And he went, oh, okay. So he went over to Catalina. And he'd had this disease for like 2 or 3 years at this point. It all went away. And so he lived there. He lived there for the rest of his life. He started the glass bottom boats, which was a big tour, you know, for the tourists who would come over. This was in about 1906, 1907. And he ran them for 30 years. And well, not even that, maybe 20 years. My father was born there in 1912. And my grandfather died free diving. And my grandfather ended up holding the world's record for free diving, 3 minutes and 48 seconds. And he would feed the fish under the glass for all the tourists. And he had this terrible accident, which is a whole other story. But he died. My father then took over the boats as a young man and ran them for 55 years. And I was supposed to be the third generation of glass bottom boat captains. And they made a movie, though. In 1965, I was 15 years old. And the movie was called The Glass Bottom Boat. It starred Doris Day and Rod Taylor. Arthur Godfrey played my father. And they shot it on my dad's boat. So I was watching them from about 10 feet away. And I watched Doris blow lines and stuff and curse and say, let's do it again. And I watched all this and I had thought up to that point, I loved movies. And I thought that's some kind of magical process that mere mortals like myself couldn't possibly do. And I just loved movies and television. And when I watched her do that and I watched them shoot it again and keep doing it till they got it right. And I went, oh, that's not magic. That's just like a complicated puzzle. And you just do it till you get it right. I can do that. And that was the day. I mean, literally in that moment, I said, that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And that was the day I just took this hard right turn. And then I wasn't ever going to be the glass bottom boat captain. And I was 15. I knew that eventually I was going to be in Hollywood. I was going to be a working actor and I was going to spend the rest of my life doing it. It took 10 more years. I graduated high school, you know, had to go through high school on the island. And I went in the Army and I was a helicopter medic and I got out and I went to Hollywood then. And I studied on the GI Bill for 5 years before I even got an agent or a job. So at 25, I became a working actor. And my first job was starring in a movie. So I kind of skipped through the bit part section, but I just didn't work at all. You know, I studied like crazy, but I didn't get paid to act until all of a sudden I was starring in a little independent film. And then it did well. And now suddenly I had an agent and I was in the union and I was only going in on movie star and TV star roles. So 10 years after I decided it, it started, you know?
Yeah.
So there you go.
That's pretty amazing. So, so after you served in the military, did you not pass go? Like you still had your heart set on becoming an actor and went directly to California? Like that just Amazing.
I went back after I got out of the Army in February of 71. I went back to Catalina. I became a doorman. I wasn't even 21 yet. I became a doorman checking IDs because they didn't check mine for the job. I checked people's IDs before they could go into the Chi Chi Club, which was the name of the big bar in Avalon in Catalina. And then we weren't getting any business. So they said, let's do a show or something. I said, yeah, there's this great musical called The Fantastics. We could use like the band members and a couple of the waitresses and the bartender, and we could do this show for like an hour and a half from like 6 to 7:30. And then, you know, cause that was our quiet time in the early evening. And, so we did, so we put together this show and, you know, we did it every night in the summer, and I played El Gallo, who was like, you know, this Spanish, troubadour kind of hero of the show and or villain sometimes. And one night Jason Robards and Jack Lemmon and Barbara Rush, I believe, were starring in a movie, because they shot movies in Catalina a lot, you know, in little coves and off the coast and in the ocean stuff, you know, boat shots. It was like poor man's Tahiti or poor man's Mediterranean. It was an easy trip over from the mainland for a movie company. So they're shooting this movie, and I go out there to, I'm singing, try to remember the kind of September when grass was green. And I look, and there's Jason Robards sitting at the bar with a drink in his hand. He's just come in from work, and Jason was a big drinker back then. He got sober about a year later after a terrible accident, but he was a big drinker then. And he was drinking, and I went, oh. And I played the whole show, and I'm back in the literally a broom closet, changing out of my El Gallo outfit and into my doorman clothes to run to the door to let everybody out at the end of the show. And there's a knock on the door, and I open it, and it's Jason Robards. He's really toasted by then. And he goes, hey, I just want to tell you, you're good. You could probably make a living doing this. Just, you know, you got whatever, you got that thing, you know. Just want to let you know. And he left. And I was gobsmacked. And literally the next morning I got on the boat and went across to the mainland and took a bus up to Hollywood. And I had a card in my hand because I had been having some rooftop fling with a girl who'd come over to the island about 2 weeks earlier. And she'd put her phone number on a card. She goes, if you ever come to the mainland, call me. And I said, okay, yeah, sure. Well, I still had the card, but on the other side of the card, it said Estelle Harmon's Actors Workshop. And it was, Estelle was this acting teacher in Hollywood who worked with Universal and all these studios. I never called the girl, but I called, I went to the acting workshop, and I went in, the bus dropped me off on Melrose and La Brea, and I went in and I met her. I met Estelle, and she goes, you want to like join the fundamentals class? I said, well, I'd like to. I don't have any money. I had about $50 in the bank, and I said, do you take the GI Bill? Because the Army will pay for for a college for me. Will you take that? She goes, oh yeah, we take the GI Bill. All right. So I literally went around the corner and rented a little rat-infested apartment, and that was like, literally 24 hours after Jason Robards told me he thought I had something. And that was the start of 4 years of study with Estelle, and then on to Stella Adler and then Lee Strasberg, but all in LA. And then I did this little independent film we shot on weekends for a year, and it got noted by the head critic in the LA Times, and Universal bought it and we reshot it. That got me in the union, and now I'm starring in a Universal film, and I didn't have an agent yet. And an agent called me, and then it was like the whole thing just, you just have, you know, all I ever focused on was just be good, get good at it. And all the other good stuff, the money or the fame or the, you know, whatever, the adulation, you know, all that will come if you get good, but you got to be good. And so all I focused on was just get good. And I really worked like eight days a week getting good. And I had a window washing route at night that I created that I would wash all the exteriors four times a month and the interiors during the day once a month of all these shops up and down Melrose and La Brea. And, you know, I could make a couple hundred bucks a week doing that. That was how I lived. And I just studied and worked on getting good. Mm-hmm. And eventually it paid off.
Amazing. Well, so Jason Robards had a story that he could have dined out on for years, as did this girl. That card changed your life, you know?
Not really. But Jason, you know, later, like 20 years later, I'm on Broadway and Jason's getting a Life Achievement Award and they asked me to give it to him. So I gave Jason Robards a Life Achievement Award from the Drama Desk, Dramatists Guild. And I was able to tell the story in front of all the hot shots of New York Broadway life and give Jason his award.
Now, because they knew the story?
Full circle, you know?
Did they know the story and that's why they asked you, or just because you were on Broadway at the time?
Yeah, no, they had heard the story, yeah. And I had seen Jason a couple of times and thanked him. And the funny thing was, I remember I was doing Trapper John a few years, you know, like 1980. So from 19, like 15 years after it had happened, I was doing Trapper John and I saw Jason Robards on the lot one day as I was leaving the set and screeched to a stop and got out and ran up to him and said, Mr. Robards, I can't thank you enough. You've changed my life. What, I mean, and he went, Gregory Harrison. Yeah, I know your work. Yeah, good, great. And I said, no, you came to Catalina and you, when you told me that you thought I could make it that night at the Chi Chi Club, you changed everything. And he said, did I shoot a movie in Catalina? I said, yes, you did. He goes, I was a drinker back then. I don't remember much about that. But hey, if I got you in the business, then one good thing came out of my drinking. Oh, he was very amazing. Sweet about it.
That's amazing.
Well, what role do you consider to be your big break?
My biggest break, I think, was Centennial. It was a 25-hour miniseries in 1979. And I was the central role in it. The guy, Levi Zandu, created the town of Centennial. And I was surrounded by about 150 of the greatest actors in America. And I was a complete unknown, basically. I think I'd had one series that went a few episodes and that was it. And it was I aged from 22 to 78 and it was like I was perfectly framed among all these really legitimate, well-known actors and great story and incredible production value. And it's a piece of Americana I'm very proud of and that has lasted. I mean, there's still huge, you know, fan sites devoted to Centennial. So I think that changed. I think it gave me some credibility. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, as you know, it's when you're first starting out, you sort of define yourself. You had to be careful how you define yourself. If you can be, your first success kind of defines you. And then if you ever want to go beyond that kind of definition, it's usually a battle. So for me, fortunately, my first success, which was Centennial, was it defined me as like, oh, he's got some versatility and some skills. So I was allowed to pursue other kinds of roles throughout my career.
So in 1979, if I'm not mistaken, was also the same year that Trapper John began as a spinoff of MASH. And, you know, as we're talking, it's striking me that there's not so like many years in between washing windows and studying and like being on the cover of magazines, you know? So when you started to accrue that kind of fame and visibility, was that exciting or did you struggle at all with what fame meant to, you know, you as an individual?
You know, I've always struggled with fame. You know, there are certain perks that come along with it, of course. There's a lot of deficits, though. I think one of the reasons why I have not battled to try and stay in the A division as an actor is because I'm not comfortable having people breathing down my neck 24/7. And I really like the way my career has gone because I get, you know, I get to do what I love to do. I get paid pretty darn well for it, but I can also walk down the street. And if people recognize me, they don't get overly excited. They might say something nice, you know, Usually they just like elbow whoever's next to him and go, is that the guy who sold me the used car or is that the guy on TV? I don't know. But I'm in a really good slot right there that I find is a great comfort zone. I've been there for 50 years now. So, you know, I'm turning 73 in about a month and a half. So, I've been blessed, you know, with having a great career that's allowed me to do what I dreamt of and yet have a real life, mm-hmm. a real three-dimensional life, you know, raise a family, live outside of Hollywood. I'm not really fond of the business of Hollywood or the show business part of Hollywood, but I just love acting and I love the creative side of what I do. Mm-hmm. And I love that, I mean, to be kind of pointed at what we're here to talk about. I mean, I love that I've been able to do all these different hybrid kinds of acting. You know, I've done tons of theater, little theater around the country, Broadway musicals, books on tape, radio plays. I've done 20 radio plays. I've done tons of movies and, of course, thousands of hours of television. But I'd never done a soap opera. I mean, I'd never done a daytime soap. I did Falcon Crest, so I've done soap operas. And a lot of the TV movies I did for Lifetime and things like that were soap operas. But I'd never done a daytime soap, and I was terrified of it. And so to add that now to this kind of a repertoire of hybrid acting milieus that I've been able to experience and try and perfect my skills at has been really satisfying. And I'm thrilled now to be on General Hospital and wow. to have found a comfort zone in it, which I started out very terrorized by the whole thought of learning 20 or 30 pages of dialogue, you know, and coming in and in a couple of hours, putting it all onto tape.
Well, we are going to get to poor Charles, Gregory. We're still in 1979. A lot has happened before this, okay? 79 being a big year, you were invited to represent Team CBS on literally one of my favorite shows growing up, Battle of the Network Stars. And one of the team members of NBC, the winning team, not to rub it in, was Randy Oakes, who was starring on Chips at the time. So now, is this really how you met the future, Mrs. Gregory Harrison, your wife of 40 plus years? And trust, yeah. I knew that at the time, that you guys were together eventually, and I was very excited.
Yeah, that was how I met Randy. She was co-starring on Chips. And she was there with NBC. I was there with Trapper John, which was CBS. And back then there was only three networks. So you had the, you know, like a 12 person team from each network, and you would compete in all these ridiculous kind of, you know, make-believe obstacle courses and swim races. And it all happened up at Pepperdine University, which is in Malibu, right on the coast here. Beautiful. And I was there with my girlfriend at the time, was an actress that I had stolen from another actor when we were on location on Centennial.
And, very soapy, see?
Oh, one of those location romances. That was before I learned that those don't work. And so I was there with my girlfriend. She was there with her fiance, who was a member of Toto. And actually she had postponed their announced wedding day because she wanted to do the Battle of the Network Stars. And they paid some money. Even if you lost, you got a good chunk of money. And if you won, you got a real good chunk of money. And back then, I mean, you know, we were all kind of newish in the business and nobody had a big bank account and the money was good. And of course the PR was good and all that. It was like the first reality show competition, right? It was the first one. And so she shows up there. I'm there. I wasn't looking to meet anybody, but you get there, you get in your trailer and all they hand you is spandex, right? Everybody had to wear spandex and it was humiliating for me to, you know, like they give you I'm trying to think of a clean name to describe them. Anyway, they were like Speedo spandex suits for the men. But the women had like these single layer Speedo one piece suits that you might as well have been naked. And she looked great. And so there was this one competition. Howard Cosell is the host of it. Just one competition where you sit above this water tank and you throw softballs at this little target. And if you hit it, the person falls in the water tank. And so CBS was up first, and I was the first one that they asked to come. Okay, Gregory Harrison, come on up here. And then, you know, you've got to pick somebody from the other teams. And I said, yeah, that one right there, her, that girl, I want her up there. And it was Randy. I sent her up there. She gets up there all sassy and beautiful. And I hit it 3 out of 3, knocked her in 3 times. The water was very cold. Which made her look even better in spandex. And this is a PG rated show, probably. And so then at the end of the three, I climbed up the steps, and as she's getting out, you know, huffing and puffing, I picked her up and carried her back and put her on the bench with her team and walked over and sat down. And then eventually it was the NBC team. She picked me, puts me up there. Knocks me in 3 times out of 3. And then she goes up the steps, and as I'm climbing out, picks me up and carries me to my bench. Well, that was the end of that. We finished the thing, and yeah, NBC won, her team won. We got second. And about a month goes by. My girlfriend has broken up with me and gone back with her original actor boyfriend. Randy has broken up with the guy from Toto. We're at a charity softball game. I'm sitting on the bench. I'm really morose because my girlfriend has broken up with me, and I don't know, is life worth living? And I'm sort of sitting there in the dugout, and everybody's warming up before the game, and the crowd's starting to show up. And I hear this clop, 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 clop coming down the dugout steps. And then thump, something sits down next to me, and I hear, "Hi, 2 drinks and dinner, and I'm yours." And I turned and looked, and it was Randy. She had handed her keys. She had seen me. She'd come with her manager. She said she handed her keys to her manager and said, "Take my car home. I'm going home with him." And I took her home. And that was 42 and a half years ago.
I love that story so much.
You got to remember, this was like 1980. This was at the end of the 70s. The 70s were a different time. I was 31, she was 30, and it was like we had sown our oats, and we were ready to get serious, you know? And we were looking for somebody that, instead of just pure lust, that there could also be some actual liking going on. And I really liked her. It was like a few months after that, somebody, my best buddy friend said, "Yeah, it's so important. Who's your best friend?" And I said, "Well, besides you." And he goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh, Randy." I couldn't believe I said it. It was like, Randy, this girl who was sort of an aspirin for my broken heart headache had become my best friend. And it was, you know, it's time to get married. Yeah. And we did.
You have to understand that if this was how my parents met, if this was my parents' meet cute, you would know this story before you knew my name. Like, I would be telling this story from morning, noon, and night. Do your kids think it's as charming as Stephanie and I do?
That's funny, because everything that was ever filmed is on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Well, my kids came home from high school about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, with these horrible looks on their faces one day, and said, "Oh my God, Mom, Dad, do you know that when you guys met is on YouTube, and some kids in class were showing it to me today? You guys look like you were about to have sex." He's like, And so, yeah. So they know too well. They know. You could, yeah, we reeked of lust. And you could see that we were a good match. So
that is amazing.
It disgusted my kids, but it amuses me.
And well, here we are all these years later, and still tell the tale. So you were right.
Last night was my youngest daughter's birthday. She turned 32, and she's a model, beautiful, beautiful model. works everywhere, all over the world. And she loves us so much, and she's so happy with the way her life has gone, and she wouldn't trade a thing. And, you know, so Randy and I feel like, you know, even though they know stuff about us that you might not want to share with your kids generally, mm-hmm. our kids forgive us for all of that. We have done something right, and they love us.
Well, it wasn't just Randy who was impressed by your physique back in the day, Gregory, because we cannot forget this important credit of yours. In 1981,
oh, no.
You played an aspiring actor who moonlighted as a stripper in the TV movie For Ladies Only.
Yeah.
I want to know how similar to the famous Patrick Swayze, Chris Farley, Chippendales audition sketch on Saturday Night Live was the audition process for this movie.
There was no audition process. I was the producer. I created the story. It was my first production with Catalina Productions. I had always decided, I mean, since I'd arrived in Hollywood 10 years earlier, I had decided if I ever make it, if I ever get a hit going, I'm going to create a production company. I'm going to not wait by a phone. I'm going to create jobs for myself. So when I first got to, here's how, For Ladies Only was the story of an actor in studying in New York who really wants to be a serious actor. And he's living in poverty. And one of the guys in his acting class says, you know, I'm working at this club, male strip club, and they need waiters. And all you got to do is you got to take your shirt off, but you just wait tables and you make a lot of money. And so I like say, oh, well, okay, you know, I'll do that. And then because one night, sort of like an All About Eve kind of situation, somebody doesn't show up and they say, hey, you, Johnny, get up there on the stage and do something. and he's got a natural flair for it. And he ends up getting famous for that. But that keeps him from being a legitimate actor, because nobody wants to hire a stripper who's on the cover of People magazine to do a legitimate role. That all came about because when I first got to Hollywood in 1971, I was also writing a lot of music and singing songs. I'd been writing music for years at that point in the Army and prior, and poetry. So I started putting my poems to music and playing at the Troubadour. The Troubadour was, you know, a big club at the time. And they had these hootenanny nights every Monday. You'd go in, you'd stand in line from about 3 p.m. And eventually you'd get in the front door and they'd say, okay, your slot is from 12:45 a.m. to 1, you know, and you'd get your 15 minutes on a stage. And producers would come, music producers, and they'd come and they'd listen to you sing your songs. Everybody would be there with their guitars. So every Monday I'd go play at the Troubadour and play my new songs that I'd been writing. And all you're hoping for is that some music producer is going to come up and hand you his card and say, yeah, man, I want you to come by my office. Let's talk about maybe, you know, how we can develop something. Well, I got a lot of cards, you know, I went in every Monday, and every Monday I'd get a handful of business cards. Every single one of them was from porn producers. So apparently they were not impressed with the music, but they went, yeah, he's a pretty good looking guy. And he looks like he's really needy. Probably could use some bucks. Here's a candidate for my next porn film. So of course, you know, I'm washing windows and at 3 a.m., you know? So I'm looking at that and I'm going, oh God, don't tempt me with that kind of crap. You know, because I knew if I did, I always thought, you know, if you did like a soft core thing, it would come back to haunt you, because you're going places, you know, you're going places. It's just a matter of time, but that would sure be great to get a few $100 in your pocket. So I never did it, of course. But when I got that production company, I went, okay, I can't do a movie about a guy who does porn films and wants to be an actor. But what about a guy, there's this new phenomenon going on at Chippendales with male strippers. I went, so let's say he's a male stripper and he gets noted for that. And then he can't get a job as an actor because of it.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And so I created this story. I hired a writer to sit down and write it with me. I wrote all the music for it, sang all the songs in it, and I played the male stripper. And so I never had to audition was the point of my answer. And it was the most successful TV movie in history up to that time. And the second most successful poster, second only to Farrah Fawcett's red bathing suit, iced, you know what?
Iconic.
Yeah, poster at the time. I'm sure it's been beaten a million times over by now. But at the time, that was, you know.
Love it.
So
that's amazing.
That was my first production. It was a big hit, and it allowed me to make a whole lot more, to produce a whole lot more other movies.
I love it.
Well, I was going to say, in keeping with the shirt off theme, your first sort of brush with the soap genre came with the 1986 miniseries Fresno, which was a spoof of the glitzy family dynasty primetime soaps of the era. So you starred alongside actors like Carol Burnett, Dabney Coleman, Terry Garr, and your character was Torch, whose shtick was that he pretty much never wore a shirt. So what do you remember about how that was pitched to you? And was it a fun project to film?
It was so much fun. And yeah, Torch was a hilarious character. I always had a white shirt, long sleeve white shirt draped over my shoulder, wore a pair of Levi's and boots, white shirt draped over my shoulder. And I actually had scenes with Carol or with Terry or with Chuck Grodin, where I would say, excuse me. And I'd take my shirt and hang it up and grab another shirt and throw that over my shoulder. And it was like that was me changing my clothes. It was probably the funniest script I'd ever read. It was 5 nights, 10 hours. And everybody, I mean, there were some really classic people in that. Bill Paxton was in it, Michael Richards from Seinfeld. You know, of course, Terry and Carol and Chuck Grodin and Dabney Coleman. There's just so many amazing comics and comedians that I got to work with. And because, you know, I played a straight character. My biggest challenge on the show was, first, don't let my stomach hang out. And second, don't laugh, you know, because it was so hard to work with all those people and not just constantly be, you know, busting character. But it was really fun. And again, you know, one of those projects where I got to work with some of the icons of the industry that 10 years earlier, I'd only been dreaming about.
Yeah, it's amazing. So then, as you mentioned, you did do a bona fide primetime soap opera when you appeared on Falcon Crest as Michael Sharp. And you know that there was an E at the end of the name Sharp, because that just makes it soapier. Michael Sharp, who was a rival to David Selby's Richard on the business front. So right. What was it like going from spoof to actually really having to play it straight melodrama?
Well, it was such an outrageous character. It was like my first really severe bad guy, but he had to be a charming bad guy. You know, he had to have something about him. And actually, you know, that ended up like, that was the first time that it ended up creating a niche that has sort of been available to me ever since. So we realized, and I think the industry realized, oh, he can play bad guys who can still be charming, or good guys who have a dark side. And it's like I started being offered more complex, grayish characters, you know, shades of gray kind of characters, not one-dimensional good guys. Like, you know, Trapper John, that was still the era when in a medical show, the only people with problems were the ones who came in each week with the disease of the week. Right. You know, it was like we were godlike characters who could just fix everything. St. Elsewhere is kind of the big hit medical show that followed us on Trapper John, where the doctors and nurses had their own foibles, you know, their own dramatic crises going on. So for me, it was interesting playing Michael Sharp to be able to try to find shades of gray that made him interesting, appealing, and yet repulsive at the same time.
Well, another notable primetime drama you were part of for a few years after that was Sisters, which is one of our favorites, where you played a love interest for Celia Ward's Teddy. So what stands out to you about that job?
The most important thing I ever did in my career was in Sisters, my character killed off George Clooney.
Claim to fame.
Which freed him to do ER. So George owes me. I've never gotten roses. I've never gotten any thanks.
You were the Jason Robards in the situation.
Yeah, exactly. I freed George to go become a huge star. Celia Ward. Yeah, Celia Ward was with George and then I killed him off and I took Celia.
As it happens.
Yeah, it does happen that way. Now, all right. You've also, throughout all of this, you know, been working in motion pictures as well. And there's one credit I need to know about. 1998, Air Bud II Golden Receiver. Now you on General Hospital.
All the movies I've done. You have to, okay.
Yes, I must. Now on General Hospital, you work with Jothiel Love who plays Violet. So we know you work with children. Air Bud II Golden Receiver, you presumably worked with animals. So where do you fall when it comes to the, you know, showbiz adage that you shouldn't work with children or animals?
Well, much of my career has been working with children and animals. No, I'm not a believer in that. I think children and animals, I mean, they will steal every scene they're in. But if you're confident and you're not afraid of sharing the attention, then they're wonderful to work with. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, acting is a kid's game. You know, it's just basically we're just doing what kids, you know, we're being paid to do what kids do naturally, which is pretend, you know, and act out and make believe. So I love working with kids. They bring that out in me. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting working with on Air Bud because they had seven dogs that all looked alike basically. But each one had its own skill. So you had like one that was the close-up dog, you know, had the best face up close. And then you had the dogs who, you know, a dog who could run at full speed. One dog who could catch the football in his teeth and was brilliant at that. So they would, but they also had to have, there was this one scene where I played the vet, you know, a veterinarian. There was a scene where Air Bud is in the middle of the road and a car is coming down the road at Air Bud and he's looking at it. And it looks like, because they're shooting it with a long lens from over here, so it looks like the car is about to hit him. And then I come running through and grab him just before the car comes through and pick him up and rush him out of the way. So they had to find a dog that looked just right, but also was stupid enough to sit there and let a car drive straight at him without moving. So that was one of the seven dogs.
Dopey one.
Yeah, that's that dog has an amazing special skills section on his or her resume.
how they cast that, I don't know. How do you test for that?
That's so funny.
That is. Now, I don't know the timeline exactly, but at some point, as you mentioned, you moved your family to Oregon. So what made you decide to leave Los Angeles?
Well, like I said earlier, you know, I'm not a big fan of Hollywood and of the Hollywood showbiz kind of ambiance and environment. So I didn't want to raise my kids and I have four kids, three daughters and a son. I didn't want to raise them in an environment where they would be obligated to follow in my footsteps, which kind of happens a lot here. You know, kids grow up expected to take up, you know, what their parents did. And I didn't want them to have that obligation. And I grew up in a little town in Avalon, you know, and my wife grew up in a tiny little town in Iowa on a farm, on a dairy farm. So we both understood small town dynamics and kind of appreciated them. And we both wanted to have a hand in how they were raised and in the school system. And so my wife wanted to live in like Aspen or somewhere, you know, and I wanted to live in Fiji because I'm a surfer. And so we compromised. We, the coast of Oregon, we had 55 acres and a barn and horses and, you know, bought a mountaintop and built a house up on top of it, right, overlooking the ocean at the mouth of the Rogue River in southern Oregon. And I could surf every day. And the only thing hard about it, it was beautiful in every way, but it was 3 hours from the nearest Walmart, you know, or any kind of, you know, Fred Meyer up there. And it was really remote. But it was a tiny little town of about 3,000 people. And I bought the local movie theater. And so I was able to pick what movies would show in town. And if you got a, if you got on the honor roll, you got a free ticket to the movie. And it was like small town America, you know, and I just loved it. And it was a great place to raise my kids. They loved growing up there. And they were, once we, you know, I mean, at first they knew who I was, and then and the town was, you know, made a big deal out of, oh, look who's living here now. But after a while, they got
bored. It's the vet from Air Bud 2, Golden Receiver. Yeah,
right. But they got bored with that, and it ended up being just a great way for my kids to grow up. And of course, now two of them are in the business, and so it didn't prevent that. But they didn't try to get in the business until they were 18, because there was just no access to it. Although I did drag them with me whenever I'd go to New York and do a Broadway musical for 9 months or a year, they'd move there, and we'd live, you know, in Jersey just across the Lincoln Tunnel, and put them in good school systems and stuff. So, but they'd always go back to Oregon. So we always had that as the base until they graduated from high school. And then it was like, oh, I don't want to leave here with just my wife and I in this big old house, you know, 10 hours from, you know, of traveling to get to LA to a meeting. Of course, that was before, that was, we left there about 2007, 2008, no, maybe less, maybe later, 2012. And it was kind of before virtual meetings and all that could happen, and virtual auditioning and all these things that are now, you know, taken for granted.
Right.
But I really loved raising my kids there, and they have great memories of it.
All right. Well, as we're veering closer and closer to poor Charles, you spent some time on One Tree Hill, which was like kind of a the next generation of primetime serials. And Stephanie and I both know people who are so addicted to that show to this day. And so, hey. Oh, you are as well. Yes, yes, yes. We know people. We have friends of friends of friends. Fine, it's Steph. I'm curious if you feel like, do you get recognized for that a lot? And did you feel like that kind of introduced you to another generation of fans?
Yeah, I mean, that's a sort of a touchstone for a certain generation that know me from that. Prior to that, there was these three movies called Au Pair, Au Pair 1, Au Pair 2, Au Pair 3, that we did from like 1999 until 2007. That another generation of kids grew up loving. I mean, really loving. That's why they made three of them. And we shot them all over the world. There's that generation that recognizes me from that. And then the One Tree Hill generation. And all during that time, I've been doing television movies and think people recognize me, but they don't always know from what. But the One Tree Hill crowd were really avid fans of that show. So they always want to know, you know, what was Austin Nichols like, you know? You know, and now there's been some issues that have been dealt with in the press about the producers and the sexism and all these things. It's like, I wasn't really aware of all that. I was going down for, you know, to shoot for 3 days every 2 weeks. And I wasn't really aware of all of it, but I loved being in Wilmington, North Carolina, and I kept a surfboard down there. So when I was there, I could jump in the water and you know, it was one of those really interesting shows. There's a lot of really, really good actors on it. But I've had several of those things. I mean, I'm known to different generations for different reasons.
Right. That's pretty amazing though.
Yeah. I think that's like really special, you know, like I think that's what actors dream of at one point in their career, and you've achieved that.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I've sort of said that, I don't want to dwell on it, but I am just so grateful to have had the career that I've had, you know, and I keep kind of being able to reinvent myself and stay, you know, somehow busy and needed in the business to play certain things. I mean, right now I just Monday night I was on 9-1-1 because I'm the father of Jennifer Love Hewitt and her brother on the show, and you know, so it's like, and I'm, of course, I've been doing all these Hallmark series for years now, signed, sealed, delivered. I play the father of Eric Mabius, and you know, I've been lucky. I just keep working. Mm-hmm. I may have knocked some wood while I
said right? That. Well, let's dive into where you've been hanging your professional hat for the last few years, which is General Hospital, where you play the role of Gregory Chase, father to Michael Easton's Finn and Josh Woodward's Chase. So how did the role come your way?
You know, this particular time, the first job offered to me after the pandemic, the first venue that figured out a protocol, how to shoot anything after the pandemic hit, was soaps. And because it kind of controllable, you know, usually a single sound stage and little storyline bubbles with casts that don't overlap a lot. And so it was sort of manageable. So the first job that came in, offer that came in, was my agent called and said, General Hospital wants to know if you want to do an arc. Now, I have to preface this by saying that for 55 years, I have been offered soaps. You know, Susan Lucci, maybe half a dozen times I was offered arcs with Susan Lucci, you know, to play the man of her moment of whatever that year was. And I always said, no. It scared me so bad. But I heard myself say, yes, tell him yes. It was almost like an out of body experience because I was just desperate to go do what I love to do. Mm-hmm. And then after I hung up the phone, I went, oh my God, what have I just said yes to? Oh my God. You know, why did you wait till you were 70 something to test your brain with 20 or 30 pages of dialogue a night? What are you, crazy? Are you out of your mind? I went through terror for a couple of weeks. And then I started the show. That was terrifying. My first day was with Michael and Finola. And I think that was it. There was a few scenes with them. They were so great. They were so great. Everybody at General Hospital was so great. And you know, and I guess I got through it. I mean, I guess I, you know, I second guessed everything I did after on my drive back home. It was like, oh no, that was horrible. Oh my God, how could you be so horrible? But it must not have been, because they started, it was a 10 show arc, and then it became a 20 show and then a 30 show arc, and then a contract offer to do, you know, would you like to sign a 3-year contract? And I was like, I guess I'm doing it right. I don't know. I mean, I'm still finding my way, but I guess it's working enough for them to want to keep me on. Mm-hmm. And I'm having fun. The terror ended after 2 or 3 weeks, and I went, oh yeah, I think I can do this. And I still don't, some people say, how do you learn that stuff? And I can't really say how. I end up with a script in my hand. I got to go old school. I can't use iPads. You know, Josh is always on the set with his iPad and, you know, just started doing this stuff on his iPad. You know, okay, I got it. And it was like, no, that's not me. I need a hard copy. I print it out on my printer. I highlight my lines and I go walk the beach. I'm in a beach house here. So I go walk the beach 3 or 4 miles with my script. I put earphones in so that people don't think I'm schizophrenic, you know, talking to, they think I'm on the phone. They think I'm talking on the phone because I'm doing my lines and practicing my lines, and there are people on the beaches walking by me, but nobody looks twice because they go, oh, he's on the phone. Anyway, so I love that I'm doing it. I'm having the best time. People are really nice. And coincidentally, at the same time, my middle daughter, Lily, has had a baby boy, Jack, who's 6 months old now. And I have to drive by her. She lives in Studio City and I'm way up here, you know, an hour north of LA. So I got to drive by her to get to the studio to shoot it down at Sunset Prospect. So either on the way down or on the way back, I pull in, I spend time with my grandson, I miss my daughter, and then I continue on. So it's like I can incorporate all, it's really timed out well in my life. I only work 2 or 3 days a week max. And at my age, that's about right. That works for me, you know? And I just feel blessed, you know, and grateful for it.
So I feel like being diligent about knowing your stuff is a really important thing for you, right? And then I feel like your leading lady, potentially someone you've been working with a lot, Nancy Legrand, is known for having a little bit more of a free-spirited approach. Like, obviously she's amazing at what she does, but it seems very different from the walks on the beach that you're describing. Was that an adjustment for you, or do you get a hoot out of it, or both?
No, I get a hoot out of it. I get a big laugh out of it. She's great to work with. But you're right. I'm not sure she's read the script when she arrives on the set. She's so smart and so quick, and she's so adept at making her choices and learning her lines in the room. I mean, I'll sit down with her and we'll get an hour or something before we have to walk upstairs and we'll run these lines. And by the end of the hour, she's got them all. We go up, she nails it. At first I was like, oh, you know, is this the process that you work? But it works. And once the camera's rolling, I just totally trust her. She's always there. She's really fun to work with. You know, I like to listen, as an actor, you know, but in order to listen, you need somebody who's actually being real, you know, so that I'm not observing, I'm listening. It's a difference. And it's like an added involvement. And she brings that out. She's just a really good actress. You know, she's a good, she believes everything she's doing, but she doesn't. I think part of her process is not to overthink it. I like to overthink. I like to walk down the beach and imagine all the different ways that any line could be said and make my choices about what feels right to me and what do I really mean, and do all this acting work and then walk onto the set and add that final most important element, which is what am I getting from the other actor, which will sort of trigger one of those variations that I worked on. Mm-hmm. So that I don't plan what I'm going to do. And no matter what you do in front of me, I'm going to do it the same way. I don't want to be that actor, but I want to explore all my options and do all my homework. It's funny. I do more homework on one night of on one day's work prep for General Hospital than I did in my entire high school career. I never did any homework on anything and graduated, you know, wasn't a great student, but I was fine. But I do so much work now. I love the process, and I love imagining the choices and understanding the author's intent and understanding. I love being able to collaborate with other people and sort of find my spot in this story. What's the instrument I'm playing in this orchestra today? And what are the notes that I need to hit in this orchestra today? And it's like, that's all very subtle, nuanced kind of stuff. And I enjoy breaking it down that finely, you know. I think Nancy just likes to come in and just see what happens, mm-hmm, and what comes out of her. And it's always good, but it's a different process entirely. But I adore her. We have lunch together almost every time we work together. When they break for lunch, we'll go have lunch together. And she's a passionate human being. I really enjoy her. Mm-hmm. And politically, we're aligned enough that's not an issue either. You know, it's like, I know that some people think she's extreme in her passions. I respect that. Mm-hmm. I respect her.
Yeah. What about the guys who play your on-screen sons, Michael and Josh?
Well, they're really fun. Michael is you know, once I adjust to the idea that, okay, I have a 50-year-old son, which is always a shock to me, you know, that, yeah, legitimately, I could have a 57-year-old son, probably, you know. But I started late in life as a parent. So my oldest child is 37. But Michael is a great guy, great actor. We have a lot of fun together. He's a very gentle soul. Michael's a very gentle man, I find. But a wonderful actor. He really knows what he's doing. All my work in the beginning was with Michael. And he was so complimentary and solid that he took a lot of my fears away. And then Josh, I think Josh actually looks kind of like my son. I think Josh looks a lot like I did at Josh's age. And he's really adept. He's too handsome. He works out too much. But but he's really a great guy. He has a great, I've gotten to know him pretty well. He's got a great family life, and I think he doesn't take himself too seriously, which I love. I love somebody that handsome and that talented that doesn't take himself so seriously. Definitely. Very generous, very, very fun, relaxed. I have a great time with him. And JoJo is, she's a phenom. I'm not quite sure what to make of JoJo, but her whole family is like that. Have you interviewed her? Have you gotten to know her?
I've spoken with her, yeah.
And her mother and father, I mean, they're incredible people. And her brothers and everything. I mean, it's just the whole family is extraordinary. Sometimes a little frighteningly, she is a little frighteningly in charge of everyone. I mean, when she shows up, it's like everyone just kind of goes, okay, JoJo's in charge. She'll tell us how it's going to go today. And she's very sure of herself, but she always knows her. I mean, her parents are obviously to do what they do, to be the kind of acrobats they have been. They're very disciplined. They're not afraid of hard work. She always knows her lines. She's always there and ready and fun loving too. I mean, she loves to have fun and tease and run around. It's a great energy to have on that set. Cause you know, there's a lot of people who've been on the show a long time where some of us are of a certain era, and to have that kind of energy is a real breath of fresh air. So I love working with her. She's easy for me to play a loving grandpa too.
Well, in the short time that we've known Gregory, we know that he and Finn seem to have sort of a similar taste in women. There was, of course, Jackie and Alexis, and Finn had a little thing, and now Gregory and Alexis are having some sort of little thing. What's your take on that, Mr. I love to do my homework on my character?
About my son and I? Yes. Well, I don't know. I don't know that I have a real take on it. I will say, though, that one of the strangest, funnest, craziest days I've ever had on a set was last year. There was that day on the show when we shot all these scenes where I discover that my wife, the night before, all in one show, the night before we got married 30 years ago, you slept with my son and got pregnant by him with my second son, who I'm no longer the father of. I am the grandfather of who I thought was my second son. It was like,
and all the stepfather.
Yes, all in one day's work. And I went home from that day and I was laughing so hard. I was talking to Randy and saying, I have officially joined a soap opera.
Right. That's a welcome to soap opera.
I had a soap opera day.
Yep. Checked a lot of boxes that day.
A lot of boxes today.
Well, one more that we possibly could see you fill someday. It's Nurses Ball season in Port Charles, and theater and musical theater have obviously been a big part of your career, which begs the question, if your General Hospital alter ego was to perform at the Nurses Ball, what do you think is an appropriate song for him to sing?
Well, I mean, it was written for a woman, but I think Sondheim's I'm Still Here.
That's a perfect one.
I love it. Well, before we reluctantly let you go to enjoy the rest of your day, is there anything that you would like to say directly to your new fans in the GH audience?
Just that I'm thrilled to be a part of all of this now. And thank you for some of the responses I've been getting on social media. And I hope that I get to continue to perform for you for a long time to come.
Gregory, this has been great. And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Gregory Harrison for being our guest. If you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.